Welcome into the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. Got a good show for you today, folks. We're going to be talking about ghosts in the afterlife. That's the name of a brand new documentary that is put out by director and producer Steve Sayer. Now, this documentary has been awarded Best Documentary Film of 2022 at the Tarzana International Film Festival, which the festival took place immediately after the film's highly successful premiere. And it's not only been up for awards, but it was one of the most watched films of 2022. If you haven't watched it, then shame on you. It is out there right now for you to watch. And as a matter of fact, let's play the trailer right now. You'll get a little taste of it before we jump into the program and the actual topic itself. Here's a little taste right now.
All over the world, people tell us that when their heart stops beating, for example, they say that they leave their physical bodies, they view their physical bodies from a distance. They enter into a state of consciousness that no matter how articulate they may be, they say it's utterly beyond description or indescribable or ineffable.
Do I believe in ghosts? No, I don't. But I've seen two of them.
Based on my personal experience in my working with patients, I have no doubt that we pre-exist this physical body and we post-exist this physical body.
Well, I think it's very important to recognize that there is no such thing as death. There's death of a physical body as we know it, but the soul never dies. The soul is eternal. When a person leaves the body, the soul is still quite normal and healthy and intact and will live on.
This life here, the countdown to eternity.
We have two guests today that we want to get to and want to talk to about today's subject, Ghosts in the Afterlife. The film's producer and director, Steve Sayer, is a former top secret operative for the U.S. Army Intelligence and was selected for Air Force nuclear missile launch. Steve, believe it or not, has died twice on the operating room table. We'll talk about that after a serious military injury, which makes him quite familiar with the topic of life after death from a personal perspective. The project executive producer, Garrett Sayer, is a former top secret intelligence officer for the United States Navy who completed 12 years of research into the field of interdimensional communications and life after death experiences in order to create this motion picture. He's not with us today. Who we do have with us today, and we're honored to have with us today, we'll talk to her first in this program, is the host of the program. And we'll talk to her a little bit about her experiences. Actually, I have quite a few interesting questions for her. Kelsey Bolin is the host of the program, and Kelsey also has quite an esteemed background. Kelsey was born in San Antonio, Texas. She grew up on a cattle and horse ranch in Hondo, Texas, with her parents, Alan and Linda. In her childhood and teen years, Kelsey participated, believe it or not, in the sport of rodeo, focusing specifically on barrel racing and pole bending. Kelsey also has a flair for pageantry from a young age and participated in rodeo queen contests in high school. And she also had a modeling break in the way of a national ad campaign for Ariat Boots and Western Wear in 2007. She's also been in the show Twin Peaks, the relaunch of Twin Peaks in 2017. Kelsey Bolin is the main presenter of Ghosts in the Afterlife and is the main interviewer as well. And we'll bring her in first and talk to her. Actually, let's say hello both to Steve Sayer and Kelsey Bolin. Hi, folks. How are you today?
Hi, doing good.
Doing well.
Good. Steve, I'm going to put you a little bit on the back burner. We'll ask you a few questions in here in the beginning of the program. I want to get to Kelsey right away. Interesting show, an interesting documentary in that we are tackling this from a scientific point of view, and this is very much a science-based movie. But throughout the program, Kelsey, and I'm interested in the fact that not only do you tackle this from an outsider's point of view, you also throw yourself into a few things in the movie as well. You have an interesting array of guest stars in this movie. One of which is James Van Prague, who's been on our show, psychic and medium. But there's also a second psychic and medium who's in the movie. I'm sorry, I didn't catch his name. That is
Eddie Connor.
Eddie Connor. Thank you very much, Steve. You sit down to a reading with Eddie.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so in that reading, and I'm just going to skip ahead to this because I found it very interesting. There's such a thing as cold reading, and I know you guys are familiar with a cold read as opposed to someone pulling forward a spirit. To me, and I'm going to be a little bit of a devil's advocate when it came to Eddie, it seemed to me that Eddie was pulling more generic things. I'm not going to say he cold read you. I'm not going to get that specific, but it seemed to me that when he was reading you, he was pulling more generic things out of the air. Do you feel like what he was reading you with was resonating with you?
I did. I had a really good connection with Eddie. It has been a minute since that read. Sure, I've actually moved back to Texas from California.
Okay.
But yes, I did. I found his segment really interesting, and I wasn't too familiar with mediumship or ghosts or spirits or anything like that before being cast as the narrator. So okay. I learned a lot throughout the course of filming.
Now, that's another question I probably should have led off with. How much were you familiar with the spirit realm when you first got into this project? And was it a passion of yours before you got into the project?
No, it actually wasn't. I was curious about it, like I think most people are. Mm-hmm. But I had not really done any research or delved into it in any, you know, semi-professional capacity. So it was a real learning experience. And over the course of filming, which was quite a long time, I did develop a passion for it. And I started noticing a lot more than I had previously. But in saying that, I have had experiences that in hindsight were very paranormal.
Okay. Give me an example of one of those experiences. What was it that got you close to death, so to speak?
I wasn't close to death, but I did see a spirit of sorts.
Okay.
I was laying in bed, and I was at a ranch, a very old ranch that had been incorporated by the family around the 1800s. And I saw a soldier sitting at the end of my bed, all decked out in uniform. And I wasn't scared or frightened at all, which was interesting to me. I would anticipate being at least alarmed in some capacity, but I wasn't. It was almost calming. And I was just thought to myself, oh, hi. And then he just disappeared.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting what people's reactions are the first time they see a spirit in front of them. It you would think the fight or flight response triggers, but that isn't necessarily so. Sometimes it's just a matter of you're trying to process through your brain what it is that's happening right in front of you.
Right.
I know that the first couple of times I had instances where I had something supernatural or paranormal happen to me, it really was a thing where you just kind of freeze and you go, what exactly am I dealing with here? And you're trying to process what exactly is happening in front of you. Let me ask you this. Now that you've had this experience where you've been through this project and you've worked on this project, has that kind of stimulated an interest or a love for the paranormal where you're delving deeper into the subject?
Oh, most definitely. I think the biggest impact that it's had on me is just viewing the world differently than I did before, and just having more of an open mind and also seeing things differently. It's quite hard to explain, actually. Mm-hmm. But it has impacted me in that way.
There's something that kind of hit me as I was watching the film, and I watched it a couple of different times. Steve and I were talking before the program, and I watched it a couple of different times. One of the things that hit me kind of hard is I was a big fan of Jay Thomas, who appears in this film. Jay Thomas, a comedian who did a lot of appearances on the old David Letterman show.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. I was a huge fan of his.
He's a great guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And as I sat there and I watched Jay tell a couple of different stories, I thought to myself, you know, in a way, this is kind of eerie because Jay passed away a few years ago.
He did.
Just shortly after the interview, actually.
Yeah. And so I thought to myself, well, you know, it's having Jay passed away as it is, it's kind of eerie to think, well, he's in the great beyond now. He's not with us, yet he's telling a story about a spirit encounter he had. And I want to get both your opinions about what your thoughts are now that you see the piece and you think, you know, I was sitting in the room with this person. He's talking about this spirit encounter he had. Now he's no longer with us. And how you kind of hold Jay to a different regard now, and what your thoughts are now that you see the piece and you think about Jay, and what you think he might have thought about this piece now. I want to go to Kelsey first. What are your thoughts about Jay now, and what do you think he would think about this piece, and what do you think he would think about the afterlife now?
I think he'd be thrilled that he still has a voice from the other side. I think he'd find it ironic. Mm-hmm. And entertaining to some extent. So yeah, it's kind of a cruel irony, but he was a great guy and we definitely enjoyed interviewing him. He was just a ball of fun.
Yeah. Steve, what do you think? What do you think Jay would think about this irony of sorts that he's no longer with us, but yet he's captured forever in cellulite or celluloid, not cellulite, but celluloid.
Well, when I was informed that he'd passed away, which is literally just months after the interview, it seemed surreal because he was so alive and so vivacious, let's say, when we met and we had our interactions on the set. And I still don't think of him as being gone.
Yeah.
And I don't think that he is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's left this dimension as far as our ability to interact, like you and I are interacting now. But I never thought of him as literally having left the universe.
Yeah.
He's still here, as far as I'm concerned. And I mean that literally.
Yeah. Yeah. Would you hope, Steve, at some point to have an interaction with him, much like the spirit had an interaction with him, the spirit he talks about in the film? Would you hope for something like that?
Yeah, I it would be very interesting. And I thought about it, but I've been literally so busy working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, which you probably are as well, mm-hmm. having to deal with a podcast, that I never focused on doing that. But I really feel that it's something that I could achieve.
Yeah, very much so. Kelsey, let me ask you, there's a lot of different topics in this film. And in the short amount of time that the film covers, you guys cover a lot of ground when it comes to the supernatural, a lot of ground when it comes to dealing with just not just ghosts in the afterlife, but different subsections of psychic activity, of ghost activity. One of the things that's brought up is something that to me is a little controversial. And I think we'll even expound on it a little bit with Steve in the second part of the program. That has to do with remote viewing. And it's something that I think in our field is a little controversial because I've been told, and you go into Project Stargate a little bit, and I'll talk with Steve a little bit about that in the second half. Remote viewing is one of those things I've always been told by military advisors that you don't have to be psychic to do. But it seems to me that I've also had psychics on that have told me that they use their psychic sense to remote view. Did you get a chance at all during the filming of this movie to try remote viewing? And if you didn't, is it something that you would maybe look forward into trying?
I did not get a chance to do that, but that's a fabulous idea. I would love to. I think it's just really a fascinating subject, and I think there's a lot more to it than anybody here knows. And I would be really interested to get more in depth on that subject, actually, and delve into that a little bit. We did have a little ghost hunt, which, you know, was kind of amateur, but we did run into some spirits and things of that nature. But other than that, as far as really delving into that kind of stuff, I'm not real experienced. I was more interested, I would probably have to say, in the near-death experience.
Okay. Was that the ghost hunt that was featured in the film?
It was.
Okay. Now, let me ask you this. How in depth did you go with the ghost hunt? Did you actually get to handle some of the equipment, or what did you do on the ghost hunt?
We did handle the equipment. I forget the name of it. It's got a name, what you use to kind of detect the different vibrations. And we went to a field where a young man had been murdered. And I saw, it's a kind of a spoiler. I saw something. I won't get into it, but I saw something. Yeah. And nobody else that was there did. And I've always considered myself quite an intuitive person, and I'm very much an empath. So I detect a lot of things that other people don't. Mm-hmm. And so I found that really, really interesting.
Yeah. We won't say what the piece of evidence is, but as I was watching the film, I saw it right away too. And it went by very quickly. And let's just say, for a lot of our listeners here of the podcast, if you have a quick trained eye, you'll see it quickly, and then they go back and show you again. It was a very good catch. And it's something that, and I'll put it this way, in this film, and to your credit, Steve, there's a lot of great evidence in a lot of different cases in this film. Like I said, you guys kind of, you run the gamut here of different paranormal phenomena, one of those things being different cases throughout the world of ghost phenomena and even poltergeist activity. But this case that Kelsey was on, I thought was very interesting in that the ghost hunt you did, Kelsey, was outside.
It was. And it was my first one. Like I mentioned earlier, haven't really had much experience with it in the past. And quite honestly, prior to taking the job and going on this adventure, I wasn't quite sure I believed in ghosts and the afterlife and the paranormal and whatnot. So it definitely changed my mind about that and helped me really get educated and kind of delve into it a little bit, which was a lot of fun.
Would you say you were skeptical or cynical? Now, there's a difference. Skeptical being that you would kind of believe, but you had a lot of questions. Cynical being you really didn't believe at all, and it would take a lot to prove it to you that it actually existed.
Gosh, probably somewhere in between, but probably more close, probably closer to cynical.
Okay, wow. So it really took a lot to convince you that this stuff existed.
It did. And I think the one-on-one personal interviews were really what put it over the edge for me. And the psychics, James Von Prague and Eddie, they really, really got me thinking.
Who was the one person that you interviewed that really had the most impact on you that made you think, you know what, maybe my mind has been a little too closed. Maybe I need to open my mind up a bit.
I would say probably James.
Really? Mm-hmm. James has a way. He really does. When you sit down with James Van Prague, he has a way of laying it out for you that makes you go, you know what, maybe there's something to this. Now, there is something that James said in your interview with him that was interesting. And I want to throw this past both of you, but I want to address Kelsey here first. And I want to see if you caught this when he said it. And it has to do with earthbound spirits versus spirits who move on. And the way he put it was so brilliant, and he said it before here on the show as well. He said he believed that ghosts or earthbound spirits are the residue of the spirit that we leave behind. So it's not necessarily it's like a shell of ourselves that we leave behind. It's the emotion. It's not necessarily the consciousness of ourselves, but it's the emotion, the feeling, the kind of the ick that we leave behind. And then our true self ascends.
Correct.
Right?
Yes, that was fascinating. I interviewed him towards the beginning of filming. So he was one of my first real in-depth interviews. And he was fascinating to me. He really was. I understood what he was saying. And mm-hmm. it did make a lot of sense to me. And I think that, you know, in hindsight, I started to realize that most of the ghost stories that you hear do involve somebody who was maybe gone too soon, maybe a child, maybe, you know, a soldier killed in battle or something to that effect. So that would make perfect sense. You know, they hadn't quite finished their job here.
And we do hear about residual hauntings, and you also hear about active hauntings. So some people may make that conscious choice not to want to move on or move to the light or move forward and go to their reward, for lack of a better term. But let me ask you this question, Kelsey. With everything you've learned in this film, it comes your time. And you've decided that, you know, or God forbid something happens and it's your time, regardless if you've picked it or not, from what you've learned in this filming. And it's time for you to move on to your reward. You have a choice. And you have a choice whether you're going to stay here, whether you have some business to finish or feel you have some business to finish, or it's time for you to move forward. Is there anything that would keep you on this planet, or do you feel like you would easily take that choice to move on and seek out the afterlife and what is on the great beyond or in the great beyond?
I don't know. I might stay behind and get some revenge.
Really? Is there revenge to be had in Kelsey's world?
Not really. No, I'm just joking. But I don't know. That's a tough one. I think I'd probably call it a day and move on along. Especially being that I'm curious, like we all are. I mean, there's not one person on this earth that can tell you exactly what's after this. So I think curiosity would kill the cat on that one.
There's a woman you interviewed by the name of Michaela, who had described, the way she described it when she left her body was there was a sense of peace. There was music almost. There was this feeling like she belonged, like she was one with the universe. Does the fact that there's almost a anesthesia to it when you leave your body, does that, to you, does it make it feel better that when it's time, you're almost soothed into it, that you're almost led into it?
Oh, absolutely. This sounds crazy speaking of the afterlife and things of that nature, but I also have begun to believe in like reincarnation and things of that nature, which is, you know, at one point in my life, I would have looked at myself saying that and just say, who are you? You're crazy. But I really have had some experiences ever since I was little bitty. When we would go to SeaWorld or anywhere where there were dolphins, they would just swim right up to me. Mm-hmm. And then when we were in the Bahamas, one came up in the wild and let me touch it. Wouldn't let anybody else touch it.
Really?
Insanity. And then more recently, on North Padre Island, the Third Coast, my husband and I have a place there, and we have this little bay boat, and there's this dolphin that lives in one of the little coves, and she stays there. I don't know if it's a male or female, but it'll come right up to the boat and let me touch it.
Wow.
And it doesn't seem to take to anyone else. So I don't know. It's just after having completed this film, things like that, I become aware of things like that. Whereas before I would have just not even thought twice about it.
So if you've had past lives, where do you feel like you've been, or have you ever been to another location on the earth and felt like that's been home at one time? Have you ever been to a hotel or a place on this earth and felt like, you know what, this has been home at one time. I've been here.
Europe.
Really? Europe. Where in Europe?
Definitely the UK. London.
Really?
London. I very much felt like I might have lived there at some point.
Okay. Is there a specific spot in London that feels like, you know what, I've been here?
No, not really. I think I lived there, and I think I was like a matriarch is kind of the feeling that I get.
Okay.
And I'm childless, you know, in this life.
Okay.
So, you know, it's a night and day from what I feel I was back then. But yes, I have been over there, and immediately when we landed, I mean, I just felt like almost like I was home kind of.
Yeah. No, I can completely relate. I don't have any children in this life, but I feel like in other lives, I probably had a wife and maybe four or five kids in different lives. And mm-hmm. this is one of those lives where I feel like things aren't going the way it should, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Like it's just not, like things aren't clicking. I mean, they're clicking the way they should in this life, but it's not the way it's gone in other lives. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yeah.
It does. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. Like this is one of those lives where maybe I go further career-wise than I ever have, but it's not necessarily the way that it's been in other lives. They call them vacation lives. When I've talked to other psychics and whatnot, they say, you know, you have vacation lives.
Oh, I am most definitely in a vacation life.
Yeah, exactly. Where you might take time off from raising families, or you might take time off from doing responsible, dutiful things, and you focus on yourself. You focus on doing things for you. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, I got married about a year ago, a little over a year ago, and everybody, you know, my friends and family, they were like, okay, well, when's the bachelorette party? I was like, guys, I'm 31 years old. My whole life has been a bachelorette party. I was in LA for 5 years. I'm good.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, you know, interestingly enough, there's so many different topics in this movie. I guess I would ask you here, Kelsey, do you feel like you could continue and do a second Ghosts in the Afterlife and continue with more subjects?
I think we could. I do. I think we could do one where we delve a little bit more into ghost spirits. There's lots of subjects that we could focus on.
I would applaud you if you did delve deeper into different subjects and even more hauntings or even past lives, because really past lives weren't touched on in this movie, but there are different things I think you could do in a sequel. But Ghosts in the Afterlife, A Scientific Investigation, an excellent movie, and I want to applaud your performance in this movie. I think, you know, you even go into the scientific part of it at the end when it came to string theory and the energetic part of the tie between the body and the soul, and when is it time for the soul to give up the body? Things that really I don't think are talked about typically in a documentary. So for that, I applaud you for that. Again, a very good movie. So I want to thank you for your participation in that.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to make. And Steve and I have talked about it. We do plan to do a sequel of some sort, maybe even a couple of them. So cross your fingers. Hopefully we'll get to do that in the next year or so.
That sounds good. Kelsey Bolano, thank you very much for your participation in today's show. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more with Steve Sayre. He's been a little quiet, but that's on purpose. When we come back, we'll talk with Steve about different aspects in the movie, different things in the movie that we cover, and things that we haven't covered yet about the movie. We'll also talk a little bit about Steve's personal experience in the Air Force. We'll talk about what he did in the Air Force and about his experiences with life after death, what fueled this movie, and his motivation behind the movie. Again, the movie is Ghosts in the Afterlife, A Scientific Investigation. We have a link in the description of this program, so you can click on that and go see the movie for yourself. When we come back, more with Steve Sayre here on the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. The movie is Ghosts in the Afterlife, A Scientific Investigation. It's put out by Hollywood Picture Studios. Our guest for the second part of the program is the film's producer and director, Steve Sayre. He is a former top secret operative for the U.S. Army Intelligence and was selected for Air Force nuclear missile launch. Steve has died twice on the operating room table after a serious military injury. Steve, before we get to the movie part of this and talk a little bit about the movie, we've already talked a little bit about the movie. I want to get into your experiences and let's talk about your life after death experiences, if you don't mind. Can we talk about that?
Oh, sure.
Okay. First, let's start about, thank you for your service, first of all.
Thank you.
Let's talk about what led to the operating room table, what got you there, and second, what did you experience?
Well, the incident was occurred during a classified assignment, let's say. So there's no way I can discuss the actual incident. However, when I ultimately, the injury resulted in me being hospitalized and ultimately undergoing open heart surgery. But before they ever got me into the operating room, I had already died twice. So the first time that I actually, in other words, clinical death, where you stop breathing, your heart stops. And I was probably clinically dead from what the nurses told me. Obviously, I wasn't timing it myself. Mm-hmm. But it was between 10 and 15 minutes before they could literally bring me back. They kept doing the defibrillator. In fact, the whole incident was such a shock to the medical staff, the nurses in it, most specifically. The nurse that handed the doctor the defibrillator paddle forgot to gel the paddle.
Oh, my gosh.
And then, so when he did the defibrillation, it burned all the skin off both sides of my chest. And then you had that time and place in medical history, they were big paddles.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so it basically burned the skin off of half of my chest.
Oh.
But of course, that was the least concern, obviously, at the time.
Oh, my God.
But so then at that point, it didn't bring me back. And they just kept trying to bring me back. And ultimately, when the experience after the flat line occurred, the clinical death took place, I felt very much at ease and very much at peace and very calm. And then I heard a voice that said, "Don't worry, you're going home." And I thought, "Oh, that's interesting. Where's home?"
Yeah.
Because I didn't think of anywhere as home, not because I was being belligerent, but since I was a child, every year or two, my family would move to a different country. And then in the military, I was constantly moving. So from one state to another, one country to another. So I thought, that's interesting. I wonder where I'm going.
Yeah.
So it wasn't something internal that I was saying to myself to calm myself down. I was confused by it, but I wasn't perplexed in a way that it upset me. I just thought, well, that's interesting. Be real interesting to see where home is.
Sure.
And then at that point, it was just a very peaceful, calming experience. And then ultimately, they brought me back. And they explained, you know, that they were going to try to save me by, you know, sawing you in half and laying your ribs open and doing the open heart surgery. And I thought, well, that doesn't sound like much fun, but it doesn't sound like there's much alternative either. And while they're rolling me into the OR, I flatlined the second time.
Oh.
And the second time, it seemed it may have lasted longer than the 10, 15 minutes the first time. It's hard to tell. Mm-hmm. And obviously, they're working on you to try to bring you back as soon as you flatline. But the same experience, it was the same calming voice, slightly different tonality, but the same voice, saying the same thing. Don't worry, you're going home. And I wasn't worried even before or after. And then it went a little further this time. I started to see a light at that point.
Okay.
And then they brought me back. But then shortly after they brought me back, the anesthesiologist started to administer the anesthesia. And at that point, there was no consciousness. When I was clinically dead, I had full consciousness.
Yeah.
But when they administered the drugs in the anesthetic, there was no consciousness. And obviously, though, I was still alive at that point,
right?
Because they brought me back. And then, of course, then they saw your chest in half, and they separate it with a rib spreader, etc. And the reason why I'm mentioning that aspect of it is because I did wake up in the middle of the surgery. And then I saw my chest filleted open, you know, and the heart and the surgical procedure going on inside the reflection of the overhead reflector that they use in the operating theater. And I was saying, okay, this is in a particularly good situation. And I said, maybe I should just, you know, kind of relax, stay calm, and wait for this to be over. And after a while, I'd say 35 minutes or so is a long. It seemed like hours and hours, but it wasn't. I mean, the surgery did take 5 hours. So it was about, it seemed to me I was awake for about 40, 45 minutes in total.
Oh, my God.
And at one point, I just, the doctor kept saying, keep them dry, keep them dry. And, of course, I'm in a drugged up state at that point. I'm thinking to myself, who the hell cares if I'm dry or not? Get this surgery over with.
Yeah.
But at some point, you know, they noticed my eyes open, I suppose, but also me attempting to speak, you know, probably just mumbling because they have you intubated and, of course, you're on life support.
Right, yeah.
So I probably going, you know, trying to say, you know, trying to tell them to get it over with.
Yeah.
And that's what I was trying to say. Can't you speed it up?
Oh, my God.
And so at that point, I could hear them going, oh, my God, he's awake. And then the open heart surgeon told the anesthesiologist, administer more anesthesia, administer more anesthesia. Jeez. And so then I went blank again. So it was interesting to me from a scientific perspective that I was clinically dead. I had full consciousness, but when they induced my induced unconsciousness through a chemical process, I had no awareness. Both times they induced it.
Now,
so that was an interesting dichotomy.
Steve, as you're awake, are you feeling pain?
No, there was no pain. So the anesthesia evidently was able to block the pain, but it didn't block my consciousness.
Wow. You know, I shared this with listeners. I just had a heart ablation surgery middle of February, and I woke up 3 times. I don't remember the first 2 times I woke up. Now, they administer an anesthesia where you're half awake, half asleep. So it's you're kind of in this dream-like state. So it's a half Dilaudid, half propofol type deal. So you're not really all the way out. You're never all the way out. But the third time I woke up, now I have 3 discs, my C5 through C7, which are herniated, and I also have some stenosis in there. And they didn't have my neck blocked off correctly, so I had real bad discomfort to the point I was in a lot of pain. And it was the pain that shocked me fully awake because I woke up screaming.
Yeah, I'd imagine.
And when I woke up screaming, they yelled, don't move at me. That's the first thing because, of course, you know, they go up through your groin with the catheters.
Yes.
And they're burning your heart at the time, you know. And the minute you move, you move their cameras. And they have to reset up. It takes 2 hours to set up. So they're screaming at me, don't move. The only thing I want to do is move because, you know, I'm trying to move my neck. Yeah. So I get out of pain, as you can attest to, you know, I'm just get the thing over with. I'm in pain. And at that point where I'm like, I'm just yelling, you know, I move my arm, move my neck. I gotta move. I'm in pain. Before I could even say anything, they said, we're going to give you some drugs for the pain. And boom, I was out like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was that fast.
Yeah, these drugs, these anesthetics that put you under general anesthesia are very, very powerful.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And what I found interesting was the total absence of consciousness, even in an unconscious state, so to speak. In other words, being fully conscious when you're clinically dead and being completely unconscious when you're under these anesthesias only demonstrates how powerful they are. When they were doing the ablative surgery, were they doing it for a valve issue or for a, was it just for stenosis?
They were doing it on my heart. My heart has a couple different issues. I have a VTAC or ventricular tachycardia. Yeah. I also have, what do you call it? It's, I call it the flippy thing, but it's actually 40% of the time it's out of rhythm.
So they were ablating certain nerves and try to get it to run at a normal pace.
Yep, trying to get it back into sync. So,
yeah.
But it turned out they thought it was only one or two spots on my heart. It turned out it was both on the left ventricular and the right ventricular side. And then they were trying to go in both sides to try to meet at the sinus node. So there were too many spots to count where they were burning the nerves. So it ended up going from being just a couple of spots to pretty much all over my heart. So we were having barbecued Tim for dinner.
Right.
Yeah. So it was, I had gone in, they had started the procedure at 10:30 and I was released from the hospital at 12:40 at night. So, it was a long procedure. It was a long day. But that's neither here nor there. But there's something to be said, and you put it eloquently. There's a difference between the power of the anesthetic, which puts you completely out, your consciousness completely out, and when it's time to cross over, you manage to escape that anesthetic, and you're fully aware, you're fully conscious.
Yes.
This should tell modern science something. And that is that no matter what you do to the body, you can do whatever you want to the body. The body is out of control when the conscious decides it's time to take over.
Yes, and as you saw in the film, when they were doing the centrifuge test.
Yes.
It's the same concept in a sense, because they spun the centrifuge at such a high speed that the blood was drained from the brain. So it made it effectively... these pilots were temporarily brain dead.
Mm-hmm.
However, they had the most heightened sense of consciousness during that period of time that they'd ever experienced. Mm-hmm. It's similar in a sense.
Yeah.
There's a similarity there that, as you say, if they start connecting these dots, which they tend not to do, and on a subject matter which I know is quite removed from this subject, but I just recently wrote an article on the climate change theory. Mm-hmm. And not one that the DNC would like, mm-hmm. but it connects all the real dots, the scientific information and the recent studies. And it is absolutely, unquestionably the right answer. But it required an enormous amount of research because there's so much false information out there to misdirect, because as you know, it's become a political football. It's really not a scientific study anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's become a political football, but that I'm bringing it up because it's parallel in a sense to what you and I are investigating,
mm-hmm.
which is what happens after death. I think we did the best we could over the 12 years of research to connect the dots best as we possibly could. But it was an enormous undertaking because there's never, never really been a documentary that ever touched on the vast majority of the scientific topics that we did in this film.
Yes.
And the same happens in other areas of quote unquote science. And it's all science as far as the investigation, but then there's people that get involved that don't want to listen to the science because they have a political objective, whether it be one of our major political parties, or in our case, when we're investigating these subject matters, people that have an innate interest in trying to disprove something that they have absolutely no reason or rationale to disprove on a scientific level, yet they attempt to.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, there's a lot of people that say that they don't believe in God. And I always find that interesting from this perspective, because every major religion in the world believes God is the manifestation of everything good in the universe. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty universal concept.
Yeah.
So if you don't believe in God, you don't believe there's anything good in the universe. But sure. Nobody thinks of it on those terms. But that's all that the major world religions identify God as. And of course, they have various different scriptures and various different ways of coming to those conclusions. But the ultimate conclusion and the ultimate belief is that God is everything good in the universe. So anyone that doesn't believe in God doesn't believe there's anything worthwhile in the universe, which of course brings us to something that is obviously demonic and satanistic, if you really think about it, because you're saying nothing's good. That means you're also not good. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the universe is not good, which means everything is bad, which is exactly what a satanic cult really perceives the world to be.
Well, and you can't have good without bad. You can't have, you know, you have to have some sort of balance. Everything in the universe balances. I mean, that's just the way nature works. I want to ask you this question because it seems to me that when you watch the film, you have, of course, you can't have believers without cynics. There's that balance again. Right. And you are going to have a fair amount of people in the paranormal who are going to watch this film and go, well, wait a minute. I'm a cynic. I'm a skeptic, not a cynic, but a skeptic. And skeptics tend to operate when you say science, that this film presents science, and it does. There's plenty of science in this film. But the minute you bring up psychics or you bring psychics into it, they pucker. And then they just go, I don't know. You said science to me, Steve. You said science. Why are there psychics in this film? Let me ask you that question. If you claim that this is the most scientific documentary that's out there, why are there psychics in this film?
Well, that's an interesting point because a college professor, actually, that my brother knows, said, oh, no, this is, he brought up this subject, exactly what you're stating at the moment. There's psychics in there. That's not scientific. That's not at all true. The scientific method is based on interviewing everybody relevant to the subject matter to determine who has the best hypothesis or who has the best evidence. So we included everyone, the psychics, the scientists, the medical doctors, the PhDs, all these people were included. Of course, as you know, the psychics really took up a very small segment of the film. But we wanted to include them because certainly they are what would be considered potentially expert witnesses if they have legitimate psychic abilities. And the same being true of remote viewing, which was studied scientifically by the U.S. military under the Stargate program. Mm-hmm. And of course, the scientific study done by NASA with the jet pilots, which was the one we mentioned a while ago with the centrifuge. So we wanted to bring every aspect. That's why we actually did a ghost hunt, which we thought would not even be, what were the odds is what I was thinking.
Oh, yeah.
We'll encounter something. And once it was done, we spent two whole days doing this. And I thought we had nothing. And, you know, when Kelsey, when she was there, she goes, what's that? No one else saw anything. And so we did, well, whatever, you know, maybe a rabbit ran across the screen. There was no defined manifestation that anybody could see. And she wasn't even sure what she saw. But then when I was going through the footage in post to see if there was anything I could put together just to make it somewhat interesting, I had no sense that we would see a three-dimensional manifestation of any kind. But we did. But it was in post.
Yeah.
Nobody saw it except Kelsey saw the manifestation, but really couldn't define it. But in post, you could slow it down and watch it move across the screen.
Oh, it was right there, my friend. You got it. And it's I'll put it this way again, without spoilers, it's better than a lot of TV shows get.
Yeah, well, that's what I find interesting about the TV shows and what I want your listeners to know. Most of the TV shows, by far, maybe all of them, are predicated on what the performance artists or the ghost hunters are experiencing in their own minds. Mm-hmm. See, so this, not that that's not something to take into consideration, because when you're using the scientific method, which evidently this college professor who's a friend of my brother's didn't understand, because he's not a scientist per se, and I won't give away his specialty.
Sure.
Because I don't want him to be upset that I'm mentioning him. And I certainly will mention his, he's a very nice person. Mm-hmm. But he was bringing up the, and of course, I am a doctor of psychology, and you're taught statistical and scientific methods and statistics and everything you can. I've literally gone through nine courses of statistics, and I think that it's really cruel and unusual punishment. But that's what they put you through. Okay. Statistics, the scientific method.
Okay.
So the point being is scientific method includes everything. Mm-hmm. Any evidence that's reasonable that you can include into the equation.
Now, there was one thing about that ghost town I wanted to ask you about, as long as we're on that subject. And this is not a spoiler by any means. The group that you went out with on that ghost hunt was using a dog, or they had a dog on the ghost hunt. Now, was that dog a bloodhound, or was it, did the dog have anything to do with the ghost hunt, or was it just their pet?
No, the dog was there because the ghost hunter who was involved had positive experiences using dogs in the past because they had this sense of intuition. And as you saw in the film, the dog wouldn't even move forward. It started to yelp and it wouldn't move forward at the point just preceding Kelsey noticing the manifestation.
Yeah.
He wouldn't move any further.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of, they had their little detection devices that they were using. Mm-hmm. And oh, that's another thing, interestingly enough, and I don't know how effective these ghost meters are or not, that they're supposed to be
right
sensing some type of manifestation that's technically observable on it, on these meters. But that went off too shortly after the dog refused to move forward, and then the manifestation moved across the screen. So it was interesting to me that both the ghost Geiger counters, we could refer to them as, went off when the dog, just preceding the ghost Geiger counter going off, started whining mm-hmm. and moving backwards mm-hmm. and refusing to move forward. So it was an interesting parallel between those different, well, you had a dog, you had a ghost meter, and you had a human observing the manifestation pretty within seconds of each other.
Yeah, it looked like they were using just a basic EMF meter,
electromagnetic
frequency
exactly.
meter. Yeah. The thing that was the most intriguing thing that I picked out of it was that the dog was there. I don't see a lot of paranormal groups using dogs.
Yeah, and I think they should, because as everyone knows, dogs are hypersensitive to certain things, not just sound, mm-hmm. but also to just intuition. Like as you probably have heard, dogs start acting very more or less in a state of enervation,
yeah.
just preceding an earthquake.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But the earthquake hasn't happened yet. And they kind of get hysterical and move from left to right. So it's probably similar. And I think a lot of the reason they may start using dogs once they see this clip, once these characters see this, they'll think, hey, that's not a bad idea. Because at this point, I think a lot of them just say, hey, I'm in front of the camera. That's all people need to see. But I think that one of these ghost hunters that have these programs, let's say like Zach Bagans, he might just watch this film. He actually lives very close to me here in Las Vegas.
Okay.
I should actually let him know about the film. I should get in touch with him, because I think that would be an important adjunct
yeah.
to the sensory perception of manifestations that are not... not physical.
Especially a dog that has some sort of bloodhound ability, or a cadaver dog, something that is worked in there along with just a regular canine.
Yes.
A canine that has an ability to be able to sense, like I said, a cadaver dog, a dog that has the ability to sense human remains, or a bloodhound, one or the other, I think would be more of an asset in the field than yes. say just a regular canine. I would think.
Yeah, and I'm not familiar that that particular dog's background, but it may have had a similar background to what you're describing, but I never asked.
Yeah,
It was very
interesting, Steve. I was intrigued. That's the first thing that got my attention when I saw the dog. I went, "What are we dealing with here?" That grabbed me right away. So, I want to talk a little bit about. Let's get into the. We talked psychics a little bit. I want to get a little bit into James Van Praagh again. I want to talk specifically about James Van Praagh. Now, I've had my experiences with him and find him fascinating. He's a very fascinating man. Tell me a little bit about how you tie to him and how you found him, how he agreed to do your project and your experiences with him. How do you find James Van Praagh and what are your experiences with him?
Well, it was interesting because when we first started the project, it was 2010, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. And around 2011, I sent messages to his various representatives and contacting his agent, his manager. I didn't hear anything back, but I kept contacting him through the years while we were doing the research and compiling this film and doing all the necessary research. And then ultimately, after I attempted to contact him maybe for the 12th time in 2000, I'd say it was about, 2016, he said, yes, I'd love to do it. You think I would have given up by then.
Yeah.
But, and I thought, terrific. So Kelsey and I made the trip down. At that time, he was living in a beautiful home down in the Escondido, mm-hmm. I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And we made our trip down from Los Angeles to Escondido and did the interview. I found him extremely energetic, extremely knowledgeable, and extremely articulate, and a very good person, just generally, from my personal contact, because we did the interview in person, okay. With a three-camera setup, et cetera.
Yep.
And he was just a fantastic individual.
Now, did he read for either you or Kelsey? It wasn't shown on film, obviously, but did he sit down and do a reading for you or Kelsey?
No, but he did give me a future speculation on the success of the project.
Okay.
He said he said that he saw that in the future and that this film would be enormously successful. This film's only been out for a very short while.
Yes. Yep.
So we're just in the incipient stages. And at the time, I thought, well, that's terrific. Just put it to the back of my mind. And as you saw, interestingly, with Eddie Connor, he predicted that Kelsey would soon become engaged and soon be married, mm-hmm. which took place.
Yes. Yeah. It did.
But with James, that was a organized reading, for that purpose of, but with James, it was just an insight that he had. And interestingly enough, another one of the mediums in the film, F. Reed, Reverend F. Reed, and he had the same premonition. So I'm hoping that they're both correct, and I think it does seem as though the film is doing extremely well so far, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and I think that it will probably continue because it is, as you say, not only that it presents all the evidence, but it presents evidence that nobody's ever really discussed before and nobody's ever connected the dots. Mm-hmm. And the string theory being, one of the theories that is becoming more and more and more relevant in our current state of understanding the physical world. And the discussion that we had in regard to the fact that the certain theories that we have currently in physics that most people think of as decided fact have been found to contradict each other. And string theory is the only theory that brings all of this together.
That's true. And you do go into string theory in the movie. And I'll save that for the movie, though. I want people to kind of absorb that. I do want to talk a little bit, though, when it comes to science, about quantum physics. And I want to ask you a specific question here, Steve, and I'll ask that in a second. I do want to add a point to Eddie's reading, though, and I think you'll find it kind of funny. And when it comes to Kelsey, the reason why I say it kind of seemed like a cold reading, because let's face it, when it came to the reading, and it's a little spoilerish, Kelsey's a good-looking gal, let's face it, okay? So yeah. To say, have you been proposed to once or twice?
Oh,
a lady of her stature, okay, yeah, sure, she's been proposed to once or twice. Is she going to get married eventually? I'm sure she is.
Right.
I could have thrown that prediction at her there, Steve, and I'm sure I would have nailed that one right on the head.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that wouldn't be difficult.
No.
Yeah.
I mean,
probably 8 or 9 times, I would imagine she's been proposed to, you know.
I'm sure there are 8 or 9 times in a night at a bar she's been proposed to.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, come on. That's not a hard one. So I'll leave it at that. That's why I said it seemed kind of, you know, cold reading-ish. It didn't seem like a tough one to knock out of the park. But that's just between me and you. I want to get back to quantum physics. In the last year or two, it seems like scientists have tried to tackle the afterlife by explaining the afterlife through quantum physics. It seems like now we've heard the term quantum afterlife or quantum heaven. They want to explain heaven as a quantum pocket universe. To them, it's easy for them to put an afterlife in their minds by saying, well, of course there's a heaven, because if we imagine it, then we can build it. But we can build it with our minds, much like a tulpa.
And our consciousness is what makes us cognizant of the world.
Yes.
So, and I think that what nobody's ever mentioned before, at least to my knowledge, I truly believe that even consciousness is a physical manifestation. Now, not in the sense that people think of physicality in our world, but it exists. And my definition of physicality is anything that exists. Mm-hmm. So certainly it's a completely different manifestation than we understand it in the physical world. And that's why the string theory is also a physical theory. That's literally what it is. It's replacing quantum theory. It's replacing other physical sciences that have, or theories of physical science that have been put out there. And I think that the string theory, there's so much proof that the string theory is the most viable, and that we could literally, through the concept of string theory, transfer our consciousness over parsecs of distance within microseconds. And also, when you think of the concept of a molecule, that molecule within itself is infinite. This is what a lot of people never think about. You can divide that molecule infinitely, not mm-hmm. only in particles, not only into different atoms and electrons and protons, but infinitely. Even one proton can be divided infinitely. So when you think of any, no matter how small, no matter how large that physical item is, it can be divided infinitely, which means we could have an entire solar system in one atom, technically. Yeah. We've never been able to delve much further beyond, you know, the construct that we can see that creates the atom as we know it. But there's something well beyond that, and no matter what it is, it can be infinitely divided. So we can fit anything into anything at an infinite level. It's such an extraordinary thought.
Yeah.
Just like we have infinite, obviously space is infinite, because there's always something. You say, oh, but then there's nothing at a certain point. Well, nothing is something. A vacuum is something.
True.
But really, everything within our own world is infinite because it can be divided infinitely, which means you can, and that's where they're going with computer technology. Mm-hmm. They're starting to use molecular information to generate little microchips that just have an extraordinary base of information. Like our cell phones, as you know, weren't only impossible just, let's say, 30 years ago.
Right.
But they were, if they were able to contain this technology in one of these little cell phones, it would have been a skyscraper full of computers.
Yes. Yeah. Yep.
So you the whole concept of infinite division and then infinite space really makes you think about how the whole universe is connected in both directions.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Dr. Sayer, it's a fascinating movie, and I'll give you this. You've taken a lot of information, you've made it easy to digest for people out there, and you've done it in what is a minimal amount of time. This isn't a very long movie at all for people to sit through. You know, you would think that this would be a two-hour movie. It's not.
It was originally 2.5 hours.
Wow, really?
But it was, people just, they were exhausted.
Yeah.
Because it's 2.5 hours of information they never heard of before. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot more discussion of scientific theories and such, but people just couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, so we edited it down to its current state, which is 71 minutes. Which seems to be the perfect point because we had test screenings to see what people could take in one sitting.
I was pleasantly surprised when I saw it was only 71 minutes. I sat there and I went, you know what? This is perfect. I'll say it's the perfect bite. So it's the perfect bite. You get a hold of it, you watch it and you go, you know what? That was perfect. It was just perfect. It's the perfect, consumer, what's the word I'm looking for? It's the perfect consumer morsel is what it is. Is you get a hold of it, you can consume it. It's not over anybody's head. So you're not going to sit here. And like you said, when test audiences got a hold of it, they got maybe a little overwhelmed. You're not going to get overwhelmed by this. And no. Kelsey does a very good job of it, even explaining string theory and explaining some of the quantum stuff and everything. So you sit and you listen to it and you go, you know what? I can see where you can tie ghosts and different theories and supernatural theories with scientific theories. It all ties together very nicely and you put it in a nice 71 minute package and it's perfect. It's perfect for the average person. So.
Yeah, well, thank you. And there was one other point that I thought you might find interesting.
Absolutely.
In the middle of all this, in the middle of filming, it was also in 2016. It was actually only 3 months or 4 months before we interviewed James von Prague. And I had a 55 mile an hour head on collision in the highway.
Oh my gosh.
And what's interesting about the event was, well, first of all, I thought when the collision was happening in that moment, that fraction of a second when it, because the car came from the wrong side of the highway directly into my car. We're both going 55 miles an hour, approximately. I was, and she likely was. But in that fraction of a second before the collision, I was sure that my physical death was guaranteed because of the speed and the head-on collision aspect of it. It just, in that time... What's interesting, within that fraction of it, it wasn't even a whole second, but during that period before the actual impact, I had a complete life review, which wasn't my intention. It evidently triggered by the sense, this is it. I'm sure this is it. And then it triggered every major event in my life in that fraction of a second. It seems impossible. But it literally, you always hear that old adage, you know, my life flashed before my eyes.
Yeah.
And I always thought, well, that's just a turn of phrase. It doesn't really happen. but it actually happened during that fraction of a second. And when I really thought about it over the years since that took place, it was about, you know, 6 years ago now, that it's a potentiality that it's one of two things. Maybe it's a godlike entity reviewing your life to determine what direction you're going to go, which could be. Mm-hmm. Or it's a uploading of your consciousness to another dimension. So once you reach that dimension, you'll still have your conscious state, or a combination thereof. Because I just thought, how amazing. How did every single event of my life flash before my eyes in, let's say, one half of a second?
Yeah.
But it did. So that's another very interesting thing I never really heard anyone discuss in any detail.
Did that life reveal, that quick second that flashed before your eyes, did it change the way you lived your life after that?
No, it didn't. It kind of was a vindication that I was doing the best I could.
Okay.
That, you know, all the incidents took place and I overcame this, I overcame that. And I did this, I did that. You know, it was literally like a life review. And it all took place within a fraction of a second. So it was, it didn't change my perception, because I had already pretty much understood from my early experience of having died twice that I was never concerned that there wasn't an afterlife.
Okay. Interesting. Interesting indeed. That is, wow. You would have thought if you would have had that life reveal, it would have happened in surgery.
Yes, yeah. You would think that it would be something on those lines, because it was so much more notice.
Yeah.
That, okay, because when the cardiologist is a cardiologist, it was an open heart surgeon. There were approximately three nurses at the time. And the cardiologist came up to me at one point before the open heart surgery. He said, I have to inform you, you only have 3 to 4 minutes to live. He said, so if you wanted to call somebody, you know, it was such a wild statement. I'm thinking, okay, well, shouldn't they be thinking of what they're going to do?
Yeah.
To save my life. But that's what he said. And I said, yeah, give me the phone. I called one of my brothers, and that's the first flat line. Because I died during the phone call.
Oh my God.
And then they brought me back. So it is interesting. You think of these things and you wonder why things happen under certain circumstances, but I wasn't sure in regard to that, when that whole, even though it was a very messy situation with the dying and the open heart surgery, I never was sure that I was going to die. And then saying, well, you were sure. I was sure in my mind when that collision was about to happen that it was over. I couldn't survive it. I was in a small sports car. The other car was an average-sized car. And I was as sure at that point. Maybe that's what triggered the life review. But the other car was amazing, because even though I was substantially injured, the car that I hit flew across the intersection, literally, and hit another car at the backside of a minivan. From the impact, my car just stopped and was all crumpled up. But the person that had come over from the other side of the highway wasn't injured at all.
Wow.
It was just the strangest thing. And I can see the dynamics, physically speaking, because it hit it at a slight angle because it was coming from the other side of the highway.
Mm-hmm.
And that impact caused their car to move and fly across this intersection. It was a four-lane highway, the intersection, and hit the other car. So the impact was cushioned for the person that came from the other side of the highway. But for me, it was just a dead stop, like I hit a brick wall. So then they were untouched, but I wasn't. But it's an interesting thing when you think of all the physical and otherworldly dynamics that aren't necessarily otherworldly. As you say, if you could have an entire universe, not a universe, because the universe is everything, but an entire, let's say, solar system or galaxy within an atom, which is entirely possible, and we have no idea that it exists, all these things are very, very... Everybody that's ever existed on planet Earth since the inception of life could still be here. And there would be no problem with finding room for them when you think about the fact that we have an ability to infinitely divide space even within one singular atom.
Why don't we just throw the science away and give you a new moniker, the living miracle?
Yeah.
That'd just be
I had to undergo these things in order to make an interesting observation for the film.
That I tell you, you've either got a horseshoe in your back pocket or you got a God that obviously loves you, one or the other.
Yeah, it's been quite an experience going through all these different life events.
You've had quite the journey there, Dr. Sayre, that's for sure. That's for sure. The movie is Ghosts in the Afterlife, a scientific investigation, although it should be called I Think God Loves Me. Yeah, it's a wonderful movie, folks. I encourage you to go out and watch it. We've got a link in the description of this program. I enjoyed it. Like I said, I watched it a couple of times, and I encourage you to go watch it as well. I want to thank Kelsey Boland for joining us in the first part of the program, as she is the presenter in the program. And I encourage you, go watch it right now. We, again, have a link in the description of this program. Dr. Sayre, I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much.
Folks, I want to remind you that the weekend is upon us. Go out and do something good for someone out there that needs your help. Take care of yourself and each other. There are people out there that do need your help, that do need you. You yourself are a miracle, and you are out there to help others. We want to leave it a little bit better than what you found it. There's somebody out there that may have a physical disability right now that may need your help. They may need your help out there to do some yard work. They may need you to maybe donate a few bucks to an organization that can help them. This weekend, go out and do a good deed for someone. Just a little bit of advice from your friends here at Darkness Radio. Go out and have some fun this weekend as well. Remember, life is short, so you got to enjoy the little moments in life. So go out there and have a little fun for yourself this weekend as well. Little note from your friends here at Darkness Radio. Want to thank our sponsors this week as well. HelloFresh and our other sponsors as well. Thank you for supporting this program. And we will see you next week for another great week in the best in paranormal programming. This has been Darkness Radio.